Okay, so for our final session, just bring up a few more points, and just that we should be aware of some of the additional issues. We had stopped in the middle of gear cutting, so we have a little bit more to say about that, and we'll just put that on the table, and then I'll mention a few other things. And with gyrus, you really could go on forever. The sugyas are quite expansive and quite fascinating, and there's always more to say, but hopefully we have at least a little bit of a framework and a perspective on some of the major issues, and that will at least make us aware of what we need to be aware that exists, and we'll hopefully have an advantage from that. So just to add a few more words about gyra katan. So a part of the process, as we see, is that once the child becomes an adult, becomes bar or bas mitzvah, so that is when the gerus is solidified. And it's not clear exactly what we mean by that. It could mean that the gerus was only derabanan until that point and becomes d'oraisa when they accept the concept of Judaism and its obligations as an adult. Or we saw that many of the Rishonim understood that really it was d'oraisa even when they were a child. But nonetheless, it needs to be confirmed or it needs to be upheld in adulthood. Although even that might be an overstatement. Does it need to be upheld? Or is it just that it could theoretically be undone? It could be canceled by a statement when this individual reaches the age of majority. So there are a lot of sfeikos that are connected to that, and it's hard to decisively be mechriya on them, but just to clarify what some of the questions are. So one question is there a need for Kabbalas HaMitzvos at all in this kind of a gerus? Do we assume that since it's not practical when one is a child, so therefore the gerus exists without it? Or is it that we need to have Kabbalas HaMitzvos later? And that Kabbalas HaMitzvos in adulthood, well, perhaps retroactively, or perhaps from here on in a deraisa sense, create the gerus, but ultimately it is going to be required. And if that's the case, then the question is, why does it not require a Beis Din? This is something that Willick talks about in his Sefer on Mordechai. We mentioned that a little bit last week, that we have to answer that question, why it is that the Kabbalas HaMitzvos, if that's what it is indeed, doesn't require a Beis Din at that point. Normally, for an adult, the Kabbalas HaMitzvos would happen in front of a Beis Din, and that's considered to be the essence of the gerus, perhaps the most important thing to happen in front of the Beis Din. We noted also that that's how the Dogma Revava, for example, in Oda B'Yehuda, explained why it is that the tefillah would have to be al pi Beis Din for a ger katan, because it's more important than it would be for an adult, because if there's no Kabbalas HaMitzvos, so this becomes the Iker HaGeiris. That becomes, therefore, more necessary to happen in front of Beis Din. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about that. It's a very interesting tshuva, where he considers the question of why exactly do we need the Beis Din to establish the Zchus. That's what the Gemara in Ksuvos conveys to us, that we are mezakeh to this child, the process of the gerus or components of the gerus. And if that's the case, we have a concept of zochin, and that's what gets all the Rishonim talking about. Is it the reis? Is it the rabbanon? Does it have to be an absolute zchus? What exactly are the terms? But it doesn't usually require a Beis Din. So why is it that there's a need for a Beis Din in this process? So Rav Moshe considers that maybe it's a part of establishing whether or not it is a zchus. That if we want to know if it's actually a zchus here, it seems to be a very complex question. So maybe the Beis Din is there for that purpose. And indeed, this question of establishing whether it's a zchus is one of the major issues in practical contemporary halacha as far as this is concerned, because if one is going to enter into a context where it's not necessarily going to be conducive to Shmiras HaMitzvos is that still considered to be a schus? And this was really a big debate among poskim without a very clear resolution, that there were those who were very machmir on this, the Tzriyesh, Salvechik, others thought that if there isn't going to be observance, at least on some recognized level, so then it's not considered to be a schus. And others disagreed, like Rav Moshe Feinstein and others also, who thought that maybe to be Jewish, even if you are not going to be an observant Jew, is still considered to be a schus, especially because if it's not your fault, it's the context that you're in, so then you're a shogeg, and whatever mitzvos you do are going to be mitzvos, and averus are going to be shogeg. That also should contribute to the picture of it being a schus. And there were many who were mesupik, and we can see what the room for suffik is. There's a lot of complexity as to how exactly this is defined. So the Tshuvas Beis Yitzchak and the Tshuvas Achiezer were very unsure whether it would be considered schus in this case. And as we mentioned, in general, with Kabbalah HaMitzvos questions, even by an adult, it's a very subtle point, because the question is, all right, so do we assume that our belief that it was a schus at the time means he is Jewish, maybe contingent on his Kabbalah HaMitzvos, but other than that, it's not going to be defined as a non-schus by anything later on, and therefore he's a Jew who is not observant? Or do we ever look backwards and say that this shows us that it was not a schus? That's a complex question. And even among those who are machmir in general, Rav Kook has a tshuva and a number of others who are machmir to say that if there's not going to be Shmiras HaMitzvos, so then that impacts the whole Geirus. But the question is still, what columnus is that? So Rav Kook, for example, in his language, he says that this is a lack of Kabbalah HaMitzvos, and it's no better than an adult who converts and doesn't have Kabbalah HaMitzvos. So the question is that what we're focusing on? Is it that the Kabbalah HaMitzvos is lacking, and it's always necessary as far as Geirus, just in the case of a cotton, it's delayed? Or should we say the extra issue here is that because he converted as a child, we need to define it as a schus? And then the question of what is considered to be a schus is going to be tied in with this. So there are some subtle ramifications of looking at it one way or another. Essentially, just to recap those two possibilities, is it that we need a Kabbalah HaMitzvos at some point, even if it's later, or is it that it's not about a Kabbalah HaMitzvos, it's just about establishing that indeed it was a schus that this individual was converted in the first place? And that's some of the lumdus and some of the analysis behind these positions. And indeed, it's a complex question, and there are other issues that get mixed in. So, for example, the Rambam, it's not clear whether he actually has this idea of a macha at a later age. It's also a question that maybe a machlokes rishonim and the poskim and Shulchan Aruch, so whether you can convert a child against his will. So we don't assume that he has asked to convert, but he has will certainly at a certain age. So let's say you have an 8-year-old, 9-year-old boy saying, he's not interested in being Jewish. Do you have the ability to convert him nonetheless? So that's also a significant issue that needs to be determined. The Ran raises the question of that if we assume that Macha is able to undo everything, so it says on the one hand the Macha B'Katan doesn't have any consequence, but on the other hand, how can we be mitzamtzem so much that we figure it all happens the moment they become an adult? And he has two suggestions there. One suggestion is that the macha as a katan doesn't have any impact. But if the macha continues into adulthood, so then it does retroactively become defined as significant, and that's why it's consequential after adulthood. Or that it's not about being mitzamtzem so much, but once we see that there is observance following adulthood, so then that becomes what is significant. That's also an issue that poskim discuss. It's also a very important question that was also a matter of machlokes, are you obligated to tell the child and give him the opportunity for a macha? Is it just that if he knows about it, and when he finds out about it, he can be mocha? Or what if you decide never to tell him? What if you don't want to tell him he's adopted? What if you don't want to give him this option? That was also a significant machlokes in poskim. What also is another major issue is the question of, the Gemara talks about matilin oso al das bezdin. So what are we talking about? Are we talking about that they found a baby in the community who doesn't have any parents, and they are therefore going to decide to convert him so he lives among them as a Jew? Or is this a case where there's a parent involved, whether that parent is a biological parent or an adoptive parent or somebody who just has decision-making ability for the child? They're all possibilities. So maybe that would be different. Maybe that would mean that there could be two major differences. Maybe that defines it as a schus, that if the parent wants the child to convert with them, for example, so maybe that's considered to be a schus automatically. And maybe the possibility of macha later on isn't there. That was a view that Chassam Sofer took in the Tshuva, and the Pesachei Tshuva quotes it. Many later poskim do talk about this, Chassam Sofer, but it doesn't seem to impact in terms of practical halacha nowadays, because a practical halacha, we do assume that they have the ability to be mocha even when parents are involved, and presumably most cases that are going to happen today are going to have parental involvement. And as some point out, and in that sefer from Nisim Karelis's Bezdin, there's a discussion about this as well, that the Chassam Sofer seems to be the opposite of what we find in some Rishonim, because some of the Rishonim, they sound like the ability to be mocha is specifically when the parents are involved, as opposed to when the Bezdin is doing it on its own. And when the Bezdin does it on its own, there is no ability to be mocha, because that's the koach of Bezdin. That's what Bezdin accomplishes, that it makes it official even without their ability to be mocha. It's also a major discussion as far as, we talked a little bit about the conceptual question of the summa, but more practically, if you have somebody who is a putter from mitzvos for reasons of das, but the person is classified as shota, whatever that would mean, mentally impaired to the extent that they're not obligated in mitzvos, the classic cherish, the whole discussion outside of our scope right now, that in the Gemara we find a cherish identified as somebody who is patur from mitzvos, even though the contemporary cherish is very often in a very different status, at least conceptually, than what the Gemara is talking about. But if you have somebody who is going to be patur from mitzvos in a lifelong way, so whether or not there's a possibility of geirus in that case is also a significant discussion in poskim that also surrounds this issue. Okay, so all of that is some of the complexity of ger katan, so it's also just something Bezdin needs to be aware of, practically speaking, and there's a lot written about what this means in terms of process. But l'chachila, we certainly look for there to be an environment that will be conducive to Kabbalah Samitzvos. And after the fact, if that's not always the case, then there's always a lot that needs to be figured out about the practicalities, and that's where major poskim get involved. Shlomo Daichovsky, in his essays in the Sefer Leiv Shomei L'Shlomo, so he discusses, you know, sometimes it's the school that makes all the difference, and sometimes it's the home environment that makes all the difference. You know, we know many people who had a religious home but didn't have access to any religious schooling, and they grew up to be great Jews. And we know people who had the other way around, that they didn't have any religion observance in the household, but they had teachers and they had a school setting that taught them mitzvos. So he thought that even if one assumes that you need that for there to be a schus, you need a religiously conducive context. It presumably could be one or the other. It could be the household, it could be the school. Either one. might be able to provide the framework that is necessary in order to create that type of environment. So this is a very major issue with a lot of complexities. And again, just to be aware of what some of them are. And the related question that we've also touched upon a little bit, but just to put this on the table also, but the question of whether there is such a thing as bitul mafreya of geiris, even of an adult. If you have somebody who converts as an adult, and there are questions raised later, so could there be nullification of geiris retroactively? And as you can imagine, again, this is a highly controversial issue, and an issue that has massive, massive impact on people's real life experiences, an issue of tremendous sensitivity and care. But the basic questions are that, on the one hand, we know that if someone does convert, so then even if they later on abandon halachic practice, they can't unconvert. They're always considered to be Jewish. They're considered to be a Jew who is not doing what he's supposed to be doing, is not keeping the halacha as required. The only question is, what about when it casts some question retroactively, when it brings up a question whether the process was ever valid? And that, as we saw, potentially could happen in a number of ways. Could happen if the Beis Din ends up being called into question, and we talked about some of the circumstances where that was suggested and where that may or may not be accepted. Or in terms of the Ger himself, if we assume that Kabbalah Samitzvos is indeed Ma'akev, so what if Kabbalah Samitzvos is called into question based on what we witness later? So that really revolves around a lot of questions such as, what does the Kabbalah Samitzvos require? Even assuming that Kabbalah Samitzvos is Ma'akev, but if there was a verbal commitment to the mitzvos, so is that going to always be definitive? And we talked about that a little bit. Sometimes there's an anansadi. Sometimes it's clearly publicly evident that it was never sincere. So do we go about that? Do we look to that rather than look to the verbal declaration? Is this a situation where we say, dvarim shebelev, einam dvarim? So all of that is a major dispute among poskim, has had major impact on situations in Eretz Yisrael and elsewhere, in a highly sensitive issue. And that's something which also revolves around this question. So what counts as Kabbalah Samitzvos, and to what extent does behavior impact that? And that's something which again, Rav Zaychowski talks about extensively in his Sefer. I mentioned previously, and somebody sent around the link for that article in Tradition from Rav Rimon, where there is a lot of helpful information about that question. So that's also one of the major issues that is discussed. Okay, so just to say a few points about post-Geiris. So we know there is a halacha of Ger Hanisgayer Kekatan Hanola Adami, that if somebody converts, so it's like he is born anew, and he essentially is disconnected from any previous relationships, family relationships that he had before. So where exactly that comes from is an interesting discussion. The Gemara has it, but the Chassam Sofer has a comment in his Chidushim Tavod Zara that he never was able to really understand where it comes from before that. Some of the commentaries on Chumash have different angles on whether this is something that was evident at Matan Torah or not. That's something we spoke about, I think, on day one. But practically speaking, so what are the implications of being born anew? So Min HaTorah, it would mean that nobody is related to anybody else. So therefore, if a ger wanted to, so let's say you had a mother and son who converted, or a brother and sister who converted, they should be able to marry each other because they're not prohibited to each other as arayos because they are born anew. But practically speaking, do not try this at home. This is prohibited. because the Gemara says that it would be a big chil Hashem to allow that, because that would give the impression shabano mi kedusha chamur le kedusha kala, that when they were not Jewish, so non-Jews are also subject to a prohibition of arayos, and a brother and sister are not allowed to marry each other, and you're going to say, okay, so then they convert to Judaism, and now they're allowed to marry each other. And this is something that everyone understood was unthinkable. The whole discussion, you know, this is something which is not only an avera from the Zayin Mitzvah B'nai Noach, but also what we call the taboo against incest, something which the whole world understands instinctively. There's a lot of sociological work gone into that. The point is relevant here, that it's understood the whole world would be horrified at the idea of a brother and sister marrying each other. So to say, okay, you can convert to Judaism, and that makes it possible now, so that's going to create a very, very bad impression and a very bad message. So Chazal fell tell us that that's not permitted, even though you could have come to that conclusion because of this idea of Gersh Niskarik Kutman Holodami, could create an extra chumrah. That is a discussion of Nassim Gestetner, has a discussion in one of his tshuvas from the Laharus Nassim Chelik Zayin about whether there's an Isser Yichud then for a Ger and his sister, or a Ger and his mother. Normally, a man is allowed to be alone with his mother or with his sister, at least for short periods of time, and in the case of the sister, and we assume that there isn't a real Yetzahara there. So if there is a conversion, one could argue that, okay, there is still no Yetzahara, that that Heter should still be there, but he is no Telahachmer on this question. See different Stadim here, but he's no Telahachmer on that question to assume that there is an Isser Yichud after conversion. But what's so very important to mention, and this is tremendously practical because it's not going to come up so often that you're going to have a Ger who's going to look to marry his sister or his mother, and you're going to have to disappoint them and say that it's not allowed. But what is much more practical and is important to stress is the obligation of kavod to a parent after one converts. So the Rambam emphasizes, and the Shulchan Aruch brings this as well, that even though a convert is not technically related to his parents anymore, he still can't curse them, be mevazan, he can't treat them in a very disrespectful way. He still has to be cognizant of the fact that they're his parents. And the Nosek Kelim on the Rambam, so they explain that this then seems to come from the same idea that we find by Arayos, the same way that we don't say, we don't want anyone to think that you're going down a Madrega by becoming Jewish, that you're coming from a Kedusha Chamura to a Kedusha Kala. So too, it's applicable to these things as well, that the treatment of the parents shouldn't become very negative, or one shouldn't think that one could treat a parent negatively because they have converted to Judaism and are not technically related. Ephraim, you have a question? Is that your hand up? Sorry?
Yeah. So you already said that again is not allowed to curse parents or anything. That'll be against the code. He has to actively be mechaved them.
So that's the discussion. So the language of the Rambam comes from this more negative, intense kind of action. You shouldn't curse them, be mechaved them, you shouldn't be mevaz them, et cetera, et cetera. So even though those are different dinim in the Torah, we have both, but the assumption of some of the commentaries is that they must all come from a similar place, even though it's not necessarily defined halachically exactly the same way. So there is a discussion, it's really a very related subject, but it's different, that some of the Nosek Kelim of the Shulchan Aruch, Kiv Eger talks about this, and the Yad Avram talks about this, and they note that it's not an obvious point, because to say that there's an Isser Arayos after conversion because of this concern that you shouldn't think you're stepping down in Kedusha, and the same logic applies to Kibud Av V'Aim. So they ask the question, how do you know that that's true? How do you know that they're comparable? Because when it comes to Arayos, okay, Arayos is one of the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach. So that was prohibited before, and we shouldn't get the impression it'll be permitted because of the conversion. But kibbut av ha'ein, is that one of the Shavuot mitzvahs b'nei Noach? How do you know that that applied before? So why would anyone think that it's a step down to become Jewish? It wasn't something that was relevant before. So what does it sound like? It sounds like it was relevant before. It sounds like kibbut av ha'ein is relevant to b'nei Noach as well. So that's a different din. That's not necessarily, that's a different sugya, which is a great topic to talk about, but it's not necessarily our topic right now. Although it's tangentially relevant, this question even without Geirus. Some, is there a halacha of kibbut av ha'ein for b'nei Noach? So this is an extensive discussion. It's noteworthy that our most inspiring stories about kibbut av ha'ein, Dama ben Yasina, who's quoted in the Gemara in Kiddushin as a role model for kibbut av ha'ein, the Gemara makes clear that he wasn't Jewish, and yet we look to him to learn how to behave for kibbut av ha'ein. So it sounds like there is such a thing, even though it doesn't have a clear source in the Shavuot Mitzvah B'nei Noach. So Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about this, and many others talk about this as well. And Rav Moshe points out that the concept of kibbut av ha'ein is rooted in the universal value of Hakaras HaTov, and that is something that is, by its own nature, compelling and obligatory on all of humanity. That's the basic step one of a responsible life, to have a recognition of Hakaras HaTov, the Ribono Shel Olam, the people who brought you into the world, to anyone who does anything good for you. So, and certainly if they bring you into the world and raise you. So the obligation of Hakaras HaTov, which Rav Moshe emphasizes, is certainly there, and anything that would contradict that would be very inappropriate. It doesn't necessarily mean that all of the Pirkei Pratim and Hilchos Kibbut Av Ha'ein would necessarily apply in the same way, but certainly the more Svaradic ideas, that which somebody who's not Jewish would perceive as respectful behavior, is obligatory on a ger towards his biological parents. That a person should have a attitude of ingratitude because they become Jewish, that would be highly inappropriate. Now, it's a delicate balance because there is going to be some degree of separation at that point. If one is trying to maintain a religious Jewish lifestyle, that's completely different from where the parents are coming from in every sense of the word. But that has to be balanced with this recognition, and it should be consistent with an expression of Hakaras HaTov. May also theoretically mean some type of Hilchos Avelos, and that's relevant also, that's a discussion as well. Also, again, not necessarily in the same halachic format, but some expression of a proper acknowledgement of the parental role. And again, to emphasize, it shouldn't be any less Hakaras HaTov and any less respectful treatment than would be expected in a non-Jewish context. So that's what's emphasized here. So all of that is also a function of the svara that the Gemara has in the context of Arayos, that we don't want anyone to think, God forbid, that entering into Judaism means that one is stepping down in holiness, not in matters of Arayos, not in matters of Berazim L'Chavero, not in matters of respect for one's elders and Hakaras HaTov. All of these are areas where one has to be very careful and cognizant that the transition into Judaism should be, in every sense of the word, a step up and certainly not a step down. And that has to reflect itself in all of the behaviors. There is an interesting discussion which we alluded to previously in the context of an even more interesting Shaila, but the question of whether a ger is obligated to betovel his kelim. Normally, if a Jew acquires kelim from a non-Jew, so then he's obligated to betovel them before using them. So would we say that this is the case now, the ger who has all of his own kelim from before? So we'll have to kasher them if that's relevant, but does he have to betovel them as well? So here, this is a discussion. There were many poskim who were machmir on this, Blyoshev and Reb Chaim Kanievsky, Reb Osner, and a few of his shuvas, the Shevet Halevi, many others. Reb Sternbuch thought that yes, he has to be tovel with a bracha. And the fun tshuva that we had mentioned before was, what if you had a married couple and the husband was malvul otavol and he fulfilled this din that Rav Sternbach assumes applied to be tovel his kalim during orders. His wife did it on his behalf. His wife was already fully converted and he was malvul otavol. So that involved a lot of side sfeikos, but that was all working off of his premise that there is an obligation of the ger to be tovel his kalim. So it's a question, Lamaisa, Rav Asher Weiss, in his Chuvas and Chelik Gimel and Nuchas Asher. So he wrote that despite the fact that there were many great Gedolim who took this position, his instinct, his netiya, is to say that there is no obligation. And so first and foremost, why am I saying this? Is because you don't find it in the Poskim. You don't find it in the Shulchan Aruch. You don't find it in the Rambam. And that would seem to be a pretty big indication, he quotes also, that the Marashag wrote that also, that you don't find any mention that this is necessary. So that should itself be a pretty strong indication that it's not necessary. And again, this is similar to what we talked about the Shmir Shabbos issue. This is not something that comes up once in a yovel. This is an issue that's relevant to every Geirus ever. So if it's relevant every time a non-Jew converts, so then you would think it would be brought down somewhere that this is part of the obligation, this is part of the process. So the fact that that's not something that we find is itself, I think, pretty conclusive evidence that it isn't really an obligation. And why not then? So he says, because presumably the halacha of Tfilas Kalim is applicable when you have a kli that is actually transferred through a kinyan, alti darchei kinyanim, from a non-Jew to a Jew. But when it happens to change because the person changed, but there was no kinyan in the middle, so then he says there is no halacha that we have that tfilas kalim is required in that case. Now maybe you'll tell me that but the whole svara is that the kalim are coming from non-Kedusha to Kedusha, so therefore shouldn't they need to undergo immersion? So that might make sense, Al-Pisvara, but we don't establish the dinim based on the Tameh HaMitzvos. So essentially, just to highlight the points of the process here, so the reason it comes to this conclusion is because we don't find it in Poskim. How can we explain the fact that it doesn't seem to be a requirement if there is such a din? So presumably because the din is based on Kenyan, and not other ways that they may end up in the hands of a Jew. And what about the fact that Tamei HaMitzvos may have led you to a different conclusion? Still, we paskin halacha based on the rules, not based on the Tamei HaMitzvos. So that is his indication. That is his inclination that that's the case. He says, well, Mice, if you want to be tovel without a bracha, okay, so matov, you can do that. But he thinks, he's pretty convinced that Me'ikar HaDin, it's not really necessary. He also makes reference there to an Avni Nezer. We talked a little bit previously about the whole Sachat Shavar school of learning and analogy. So here he quotes that the Shem Yishmuel, in a few places, quotes from his father, the Avni Nezer, says that there is no need for Tfilas Kalim because the Tfila of the Ger works for his Kalim as well. So when the Ger converts and when he himself immerses, he brings all his Kalim with him. So he didn't find that very convincing, and the analogy that's brought there, he didn't think was really to the point. But for his own reasons, he thinks that this is the same din, even though he doesn't come at it from the same place. So he thinks that that should be the conclusion. I asked the Rabbi Reis what his policy is as far as this question is, and he says that he advocates tefillah without a bracha because of this machlokas, essentially. In deference to this position of the Shem Yishmuel, which comes from a different place, but comes to the same point, that there may not be a requirement, so therefore not to make a bracha, but because of all these poskim who did require it, that was why he advocated that policy. We'll essentially close the way we started, just to say a few words about, we read in this past week's Parsha, in Parsha's Akev, that there is a mitzvah of Avos Sager. And throughout the Torah, it's a question how exactly to count, but the Gemara emphasizes that we find throughout the Torah that there is a prohibition to be ma'ane hager, that one is not allowed to hurt the feelings of a convert, and that one has a positive obligation of ahava. So there's a lot to figure out exactly about what the message is, especially because we have this prohibition by everybody, so we're not allowed to hurt anybody's feelings, and we're obligated, we have an obligation of ahava anyway. So why does the Torah give us additional mitzvot that seem to be repetitive as far as ger is concerned? So there's a lot that we can assume as a part of this picture. Sometimes a mitzvah is repeated for emphasis, and it's a way of saying this is more important, and that it attaches itself to our whole essence. And the Torah keeps emphasizing that because we were gerim, we were strangers, so to speak, in Mitzrayim. So it's not emphasizing, and it's probably to the point also, that saying we were gerim, not like we said on day one that we are converts from Har Sinai, but that we were outsiders in Mitzrayim, and we know what it's like to be outsiders, so therefore that has to come to define our attitude towards people. And that becomes a crucial aspect of our whole essence, and therefore perhaps in the context of the ger, it takes on greater importance. Also in recognition of the fact that there is a greater challenge, that the ger is going to experience a greater need for ahava and a greater sensitivity. So it's understandable that this is something that's going to be reminded to us again and again, and it may also require an additional degree in order to compensate. And it's striking that even we look at the mitzvah of Yehav L'Arecha Kamocha, so we find one mitzvah, but it applies to different degrees to different people. We know that from the Gemara in the beginning of the second parak of Kedushin, which tells us that you shouldn't use a shliach l'Kedushin because you might not be happy with the girl your shliach picks out, and it'll be a lack of Yehav L'Arecha Kamocha. So what emerges from that Gemara is that same mitzvah, Yehav L'Arecha Kamocha, applies to everyone, is also what dictates the way one should relate to his spouse, and obviously that's going to be of a completely different degree by order of magnitude than any other person, but it's a mitzvah that has a whole spectrum to it. So too, with a ger, to recognize that there is a greater need for love and a greater need for sensitivity, and that's something that should manifest itself. And if the Torah emphasizes this again and again, so it's something that very much should be practical. And it's not clear that this is always playing out the way it should. We hear a lot of dissatisfaction sometimes, unfortunately, with the way the community treats gerim. And hopefully it's not always the case, but sometimes it's the case. And it needs to be emphasized and reemphasized that this is a crucial mitzvah in the Torah, which indeed it does reemphasize, indeed tells us again and again. And it also is a fulfillment of Halachta B'Drachah, because the Torah tells us again in this pasuk's parsha that God loves gerim, and that's something that needs to reflect itself, even if, unfortunately, it hasn't always been the case, hasn't always reflected itself to the degree that it should. And I think it's also important that appreciate that what we saw again on day one is that it doesn't seem like this is only a consequence of a gerus that has been fulfilled with perfect adherence to all standards and one that has already been fulfilled, because we saw from the Tosfos Harash and from the Rebbe Barcelona and others that there is a mitzvah of Avos Ager potentially even before the Ger has converted. And it makes sense also, Al Pi Svara, that the issue here is to be welcoming and to be sensitive to a person who has this mindset that they want to join the Jewish people, and they have also this sense of dislocation of coming in from the outside. And that requires sensitivity throughout, even if the Gerus hasn't happened yet, or even if the Gerus turns out to be questionable. It makes sense that there is a sensitivity and an obligation that's relevant there as well, even if it may require taking certain halachic steps, but that doesn't absolve one of the responsibility. Now, theoretically, you could have somebody who was never serious about Gerus in the first place and was manipulating the system and the like. So it's not to say that it's always going to be there, but in many of these situations, we should be sensitive to the fact that this set of obligations is one that is very relevant and is not always fully fulfilled. We've made many references to the Chicago Bezdin and Beris, or Beris's associate and predecessor in the Chicago Bezdin, Gedalia Dov Schwartz Shlita. And Schwartz has authored a quintus on Ava Sager, which I don't have yet, but I was informed is available from the CRC, so I'm going to make efforts to acquire it, and I'm sure there is a lot of valuable information there about this mitzvah. Also in the Sefer L'Riacha Kamocha, if you're familiar with that Sefer, it's about 10 volumes on issues of Ben Adam L'Chavero. He has a number of pages in the back of one of the volumes about this mitzvah of Avos Hageir, is something which we have to be very careful about and take very seriously. You know, the Torah in this week's Parsha, in Parsha's Re'eh, so the Torah tells us about all the Moadim, and among the messages from the Moadim, so when it talks about Shavuos, so it tells us that we have to remember that we were Avadim in the Mitzrayim. And that's hard to understand because we know that Pesach is about Yetzias Mitzrayim, and we know that Sukkot is about Yetzias Mitzrayim, but Shavuos doesn't really seem to be about Yetzias Mitzrayim. Shavuos seems to have its own theme. So how come in the context of this week's Parsha of Shavuos do we find that the emphasis is there as well on Yetzias Mitzrayim? And Tar Tamima has a comment about this. And there's a commentary on the Torah Tamima that was written by my grandfather, Zichron Lebracha, called the Sefer's called Meshivas Nefesh. And there he has a different angle on the Torah Tamima, and he suggests that the Torah is emphasizing to us that if we're going to have Simchas Yontif, you're going to celebrate a Yontif. So we know the Rambam says that Simchas Yontif only counts if you also welcome in the Aniyim and you welcome in those who are dislocated, otherwise the simcha is not a genuine simcha. And therefore, in order to make that point, the Torah very often emphasizes that we have a history of ourselves needing help, of being dislocated, of being gerim in the sense of being outsiders, and that sensitivity is supposed to always inform what we do and our ability to empathize with those who need help, with those who may be out of their original context, for those who may not have as many friends as they could use. All of this is a part of the core Jewish value system, and it has to express itself here as well. And I'll just mention very briefly that this is also something which needs to be balanced, because there are sometimes halachos that do distinguish between a ger and a non-ger, and it makes things a little complex. We spoke a little bit about the question of whether a ger can serve on a bezdin for gerus. There is a lot to discuss about the whole concept of sorara, of communal leadership, and gerus. I'm not going to go into all of the details, but it's an extensive discussion in poskim, whether there is a limitation as far as rabbanus, as far as being a rosh yeshiva, as far as a position of sorara. What exactly the issue is itself a discussion. I thought that suggested in the past, you can tell me if you think this is true, but I think it also flows with the language of the Rambam, that the Rambam says, when we talked about, again, to go back to day one, that we should be on the lookout for motivations that are not so pure. So the Rambam mentions that if somebody says he wants to convert so that he'll be a big shot, he'll have a position of Sarara, so then that's a reason not to be so eager. It's a reason not to be so welcoming. So perhaps as a part of that concern, we don't want people saying, okay, I'll convert to Judaism and I'll become somebody who's hero, somebody who's a hotshot. So we want to discourage that kind of motivation. Perhaps that's a part of it. It's unclear. It's a suggestion. But Rav Moshe Feinstein does discuss in his shuvas. You can look at Chelik Yeridea, Chelik Dalet, Siman Chavav, when he talks about some of the practicalities of this. He talks about how it is a balance between this and this mitzvah that we have of Avos Ager, and to make sure that nobody feels excluded, and to make sure that there isn't any discouragement for somebody who is a sincere convert to enter into Yadus, to stay committed to it afterwards. These are all aspects that we have to very much be sensitive to, we have to very much be aware of, and that's a part of how this is going to play out. So it may require a delicate balance, but that is all a part of how we connect to this very significant and very complex area of halacha. And we also mentioned on day one that the whole question of what the mitzvah is, the mitzvah on the ger, the mitzvah on the bezdin, that this is all a expression of avas Hashem, of loving God. And so we love God. We want to help those who love God and are looking for a higher level of commitment to be able to express that. Our acts of chesed are an expression of halachta bedrachav, and to help somebody realize their love of God in the fullest way is itself an act of chesed. And the Gemara says that shehei shem shemayim mitzahei val yadacha, that part of avos Hashem means that we should allow others to see that love and to express that love. So all of that is very fundamental to who we are. And as we approach the month of Elul and the time of real Hiskarvus and the month of Ani L'Dodi, the Dodi Li, where this idea of Avos Hashem is so front and center in what we're trying to perfect as we approach the Yemei Hadin, our attitude towards this should very, very carefully be refined and honed. So those are some thoughts. I thank you very much for joining me for these weeks to get a little bit of a introduction to some of the concepts of Hilchos Geiris. Just to recap, today we went through some more topics of Ger Katan and the Macha, whether that was a Kabbalah Samitzvus or a definition of the Schus, what exactly is a Schus. How do we look at it? Are there differences if parents are involved, if they're not involved, et cetera, et cetera? We talked about the question of bittul l'mafreya, if that's something that we know shouldn't be possible, that the geiris is permanent, but maybe when there's indication that it wasn't effective at the time, is that something that indeed has such an impact? Gets involved in the question of what exactly is Kabbalah HaMitzvot, if there are sometimes counterindications. And then we talked about Katan Gerish Nisgara Katan Hanola Dami, and the implications as far as Arayus, and Yichud, and Kibud Av Ve'Eim, and treatment of parents overall. And then the question of Tfilas Kalim, that some poskim thought there was an obligation of Tfilas Kalim. Rav Asher Weiss thought that there is not an obligation of Tfilas Kalim, as did the Avni Nezer, and we talked a little bit about that. And then we got into the mitzvah of Avos Ager, and all of its important implications, and how that goes to reflect the essence of what Klal Yisrael is about, and why we find such an emphasis on that. And we talked a little bit about the question of some halachic distinctions, and what they may be based on, and how they play out. But to re-emphasize that whatever they are, they have to be handled with great sensitivity, and a recognition that ultimately not only these many reiterated mitzvos of avoiding anas ager and expressing avos ager are at stake, but that all of that is a function of our own avos Hashem and our own chesed, which is the essence of Klal Yisrael. And as we approach Elul, our focus on these values is ever more important. I wish everyone a wonderful rest of the summer and a wonderful rest of the year. And again, if you want to work out issues of credit, be in touch with me. And if you want to work out anything else, be in touch with me. Please feel free and encouraged to be in touch. And it's the only good things. You should stay safe and healthy.
from Maine. Thank you, Rebbe.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's your call.
Thank you, Rebbe.
Thank you.
Question?
Yes.
I asked Rebbe Reese when he was here about the fair custom policy for the Asian America.
Uh-huh.
He used to say that that if there was an issue, like let's say one of the parents isn't Jewish and they're intermarried currently, and the father wants to convert, like he seems to imply that that would be more problematic than if they're like separated and then the father just wants the child to convert, but they're going to be spending a lot of time with the religious parents, so they'll be in an environment to grow rather than parents are intermarried. How much of a split is it? So if that's the case, it sounds like if you know somebody that's in the situation that they wouldn't have gone through an Orthodox conversion, would that make an impact? Would that make any practical impact to treating this person in an Orthodox community? If you know people, like...
You mean treating them, you were saying, as far as recommending the Geirus or as far as going through the...
It's like a holding, like maybe coming, like let's say they dominate your shul or like that kind of... Like how do you treat these people if you know there's a custom that... That's a child of an intermarried couple that, you know, probably didn't go through I imagine they didn't go through an Orthodox conversion if they're still intermarried.
So the question of how do you treat them, like I said, is a part of what we're saying here, that to recognize that everyone should be treated with respect and sensitivity,
right.
And that this mitzvah, I think, of Yehatzim the Segera very likely applies in these circumstances, whether or not the Geras is valid. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you can necessarily allow all the other aspects. There's a lot of complexities if you're ahead of the school, so you want to make sure you have Jewish students in the school for a lot of reasons. It also impacts potential intermarriage questions for others. This is something which has great stakes. So how every situation is unique. Every situation has its own set of facts, and you can't address these questions in the general sense, because there's always going to be details. As far as just the basic question of whether the Geirus was effective, so as we see, there is a big machlokas here, and that a lot of it goes to the question of l'chachila, what do you recommend? But after the fact, there's a very strong possibility that these Geiruses are effective even in those circumstances. So even if you just want to look at it very technically, so this is, again, it's going to be something that the poskim of a school or of a shul or whoever is looking into the issue are going to have to consider. But there is a very strong possibility, at least in the Safek, or at least more than that, that there may be a technical validity to the Geirus. But again, I think what we do need to appreciate is whatever the policy is going to be in every case, it has to be expressed with sensitivity and consideration, and people's lives are involved. And the emotional investment is humongous, and especially you're also, if there was something that went wrong, very often it's not the fault of the person in front of you who is acting in complete good faith. So it's crucial to try, and obviously easier said than done, because there's so much that's being balanced, but to bring the full appreciation of the human element into it, regardless of what the decision is, is something which has to be brought into the equation. So basically, just in broad strokes, what are we addressing here? So there are some significant halachic stakes for school, for sure, for shul also, and that does have to be taken with utmost seriousness. There is a strong possibility, at least b'di'evit, or at least according to some poskim, the Geirus may be good even in some surprising circumstances. But also the technical validity of the Geirus is not the only question. I mean, the question is also how do you convey things and how do you address things and all of that. So that's the part of what it takes a lifetime to work on. We spend a lifetime trying to express ourselves properly and trying to think about other people in a proper way so that we really identify with the suffering of someone else and the sense of dislocation and, you know, very often a complete life-redefining consequences. And part of what we hope is our smicha training, but our whole lifelong working on ourselves as we approach Elul, is that the balance comes across properly. So that's the first thing to work on, the first and the last thing.
Would we give those people kibbutzim?
it's, you know, again, you were talking about a very broad category of people. There's so many different circumstances, and not all the kibbutim are equal, not all the implications are equal. So every case has to be looked at in its own set of facts, in its own set of situations, but having the necessary sensitivity to the first and the last step. That's what you, the first thing to think about, and the last thing to think about, and then in between, make sure to make the right decision. Okay, I know it doesn't really answer your question, but hopefully that's it.
You can speak personally, privately, if I know certain cases.
Yeah, every case is unique. And again, part of bringing in Rabbi Reis was also to make that resource available, so you know that he's somebody with tremendous experience and involvement in these areas. You can also turn to Moshe Blank. You had a question also.
I was just asked, like, a very particular, like, Derek Cochran question. Like, in the Sugya. Like, nothing. Like, from myself.
Okay, so, yeah, we can talk afterwards if that's... I have a great sefer now on Algeria Hasidic, which talks a lot about it. So, you can look there. So,
thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Kol tov.